My name is Alex, and I'll be your host today. Thanks for joining us for episode 2. I'm really excited to get into some material today. And yeah, so during this episode, I want to take a big picture look at investing. All right, so before we even talk about stocks, why even stocks? Why should we think about stocks? What are some things that it can do? What are some advantages, disadvantages? But what are the other options out there? There's so much media, so much news, so much information out in the world today about investing and how can we grow our money, right? That's always the purpose, is how do we multiply what we have in order to achieve our goals and achieve our dreams? So I want to take an episode to really go over the big picture. So what can you invest in and what are the characteristics of these different vehicles? And before we get started on that, I'd like to start on a philosophical note, because a lot of times there's so much talk about the product of the investment. What fund should I invest in? What is gold good right now? What about Bitcoin? There's all these things, and maybe those will be great investments for you. But before that, before we can even think about that, we have to think about ourselves. What is driving those returns? It's money that we put forth in plants so that it can multiply. But where does that come from? The best thing to invest in ever is always yourself. It's your skills, it's your relationships, the people that you know, the things that you can do to help others. That's always the best investment. And if you don't have skills, you can't generate an income. And if you can't generate an income, you can't take a portion of that income to grow it. That's just plain and simple. You know, when I first learned about compound interest, when it first really crystallized in my brain, like I mentioned last episode, when I was in college reading that David Bach book, I was just so blown away that, wow, like, you know, if you can invest $200 a month for 40 years, you can be a millionaire. And that made me really thirsty to invest. But the thing is, the truth was, there really wasn't much I could do because I was learning so much about the specifics of investing at that time, but I didn't yet have a proper foundation. I was a college student and I had no money. So good luck, right? So scale matters. You can know almost nothing about investing and focus solely on building your income, for example, by becoming a doctor or becoming a lawyer or some other profession where you have the potential for generating a high income, and not know that much about investing, maybe know some basics. But if you can invest 10 grand a month into something that does okay, you're going to do pretty well over a long enough period of time. So that's pretty cool. It matters what you put into it. Contrast that with someone who's just kind of scraping by, but they manage to pick some brilliant investments that quadruple in a year. Well, that's great, but if you turn $100 into $400 in a year, that's a $300 gain, as compared to someone who already is starting from a capital base of $100,000, let's say, and they earn 5% on their investments and they make $5,000 in a year. So the scale matters a lot, and that's an important point that I don't want to leave out, because all the things that we're going to talk about in this podcast is relating just to that rate of return component and the safety of that return. But before you even get to that, you have to think about, what are your skills? What are your passions? How are you going to generate an income from that, not only to provide for your family in the here and now, but in the future as well? And also just growing yourself as a person too. So the lesson for that is, in the early phases of life, the percentage of income that you save, it matters a lot more than the return on your investments. And in addition to this, rate of return matters, but it starts to matter more and more the longer that you live. Because of the mathematical nature of compounding, you get that exponential growth over 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years even. That curve goes crazy once you live that long and stay invested for that long. So early in life, focus on your skills. Of course, really always be building your skills, but focus on your skills, your income. That is always the best and first investment that I try to think about. And it may be trite, but it's right. We all need to invest in ourselves before trying to grow our capital. So now on to the three asset classes. So I first learned this idea from Todd Tressider, who's a very experienced investor. He used to run a hedge fund, but now he runs the business, The Financial Mentor. I highly encourage you to check that out. He's got a podcast called Financial Mentor, where he interviews a lot of entrepreneurs, and he's written tons of books and just has an overall great website that dives into a lot of personal finance type of stuff. So this idea is not original to me, but I think it's very important for setting up the content of this podcast, and I kind of want to tell you my thoughts on it. So there are three main asset classes that you can invest in. And within each asset class, you can break that down into a lot of sub-asset classes too. So the first one is private business. The second one are real assets, specifically real estate. And then third, you have paper assets. And those are your stocks, those are your bonds, those are your currencies, your CDs at the bank. So in a nutshell, that's what we're going to be talking about today. So let's get into the first one, a private business. So this is pretty intuitive. If you go and lease a space on the main street in your hometown, you get some tables, some chairs, some ovens, you get some dough, you can open a pizza parlor. You create the equity as opposed to helping grow it. So you're taking an idea, you're finding a product or service in the marketplace that needs customers, that something people want and are desperate for, and you give it to them, and they trade you money for that product or service. And then over time, you grow that. And so that's the essence of entrepreneurship. It's the essence of private business. And as an asset class, it's pretty amazing. I mean, if you have a basic skill set, such as you know how to mow a lawn and trim hedges and blow leaves, you can start a business as a solopreneur landscaper and just basic lawn maintenance, go around selling your services to people. And you can eventually hire one person to help you, two people to help you, and you can grow that. And that's a private business. And it's pretty cool because one of the advantages of this asset class is in many cases, you can start a business with little to no money. And the thing is, it always requires time, though. But you can start it with little to no money in many cases. So this is how people create very large amounts of wealth, sometimes in short periods of time. So if you were to go over to the, you know, the big list, if you were to go to the Forbes 400 list or billionaires list, whatever, those people, they all created their wealth ultimately off of businesses. And that's basically the asset class that goes to that level, at least at the core of it. So an example is Warren Buffett. Many people know him because he's one of the greatest stock investors of all time, or just greatest investors of all time. But Warren Buffett didn't just get rich because he picked a lot of great stocks. He created scalable businesses in the form of investment partnerships way back when he was in his 20s. And he took a cut of the profits as an owner of that business and then grew those profits, reinvesting them into the product he was selling, which was his investment partnerships, which were the stocks and businesses he was buying. So he kind of had this double effect. He was making money from the investments themselves that he was buying, but he owned the partnership where he managed the assets of other people. In the beginning, he just started with his friends and family back in Omaha, and he took a cut of those profits. So, so that's really how he scaled up and became who we know him as today. Another advantage of private business ownership is that there's nearly unlimited potential for growth. The growth is influenced more by variables under your control. So your annual rate of return could be thousands and thousands of percent a year or more because you're creating something from almost nothing. You're seeing untapped potential out there in the world, and you're saying, hey, I'm going to meet that demand in X, Y, or Z fashion. And it's a pretty beautiful thing to witness. I haven't done it at this stage in my life. I've heard a lot of stories about people who have done it. I've seen it with my own eyes, and it's pretty cool. Another advantage is that market inefficiencies can be exploited. So maybe you see a product or service out there that's just not cutting it, and you know, if you tweak just that one thing and, you know, and you sell it on Amazon, that's just a little bit better, that you can totally dominate the market share of that niche because you're just noticing that inefficiency, that people are really, really begging for a particular feature or whatever the case may be. So that's another advantage, is you can exploit market inefficiencies rather well. So onto the disadvantages of this asset class. So you have to actually operate the business or delegate its operation. This requires work and skill in whatever industry you're going into. So even something like a franchise, say a McDonald's franchise or a Dunkin' Donuts, maybe you don't do all of the work physically yourself, but you still have to oversee it. You have to understand what's going on, know what your employees are doing, and you have to be a good manager, a good operator. And that requires time and attention and skill, even from the ownership perspective. And even more so if it's not a more thoroughly proven system like a Subway franchise or something like that. You have to run the business and get it going, establish the systems, at least in the beginning. And so that's a disadvantage. It takes a lot of time and a lot of effort to do that. And another disadvantage is that there's a high risk of failure. There's a statistic, I forget exactly the number, but I think it's at least 4 out of 5 businesses fail within the first year. And it's tough out there, especially if there's a good idea out there. There's a good chance that somebody has either already done it or are working very hard to do it already. It doesn't mean that you can't be successful in it, of course. It just means that there's a lot of competition out there. You have to be wary of that and trust in building your skills and your confidence and understanding your market very well. So it requires a lot of skill, and yeah, you could completely fail. So there's that too. All companies that are now publicly traded stocks eventually trace their origin back to somebody somewhere starting it as a private business. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about stock ownership, is that somebody took some idea, they nurtured it, they grew it into something that became, that had huge influence or has huge influence on a large number of people. And you can participate in that via stocks, and that's pretty cool. But just remember that whatever the business is, it always started as a private business. And that particular founder, if they structured things right and they cared for their business and they didn't dilute their ownership too much along the way, they're the ones that are always going to make the most from the investment than the owners down the line, because they retained their ownership and they had that ownership while it was still small and got to participate in the massive growth from the very beginning. So all around, that's the asset class of private business. And yeah. So the next asset class are real assets. Now, mainly here, I'm talking about real estate, but I'm also talking about physical assets such as commodities, such as gold, silver, coin, oil. And these are the raw resources on the physical earth and in the universe. I guess now we could start mining asteroids for water and minerals and things like that. But these are the raw resources that can be put to productive use by varying degrees. So I'm mainly going to focus here on real estate because it's one of the most accessible forms of real assets, and many, many people have proven its worth as an investment over the years. So real estate, it's one of the most tangible examples. We all probably live and work in someone's real estate, and houses, apartment complexes, office buildings, somebody somewhere owns all of them. So wherever you are right now, if you're driving in the car or you're sitting at home looking out the window where you're working out in a gym or something, look around you for a second. Notice the physical space that you exist in. Notice the buildings as you're driving by them. Notice the building you're sitting in right now. Somebody owns it. Somewhere. Maybe it's part of a private equity deal. Maybe it's part of a publicly traded real estate investment trust, or maybe just the guy down the street owns the building. Who knows? But somebody somewhere owns it, and it's really kind of awe-inspiring when you think about it. Like, wow, somebody has control of this land and this property, and they're generating value somehow through that piece of property, or hopefully they are. An example is McDonald's. So McDonald's, one of the reasons it became so successful as a franchise and as a restaurant, I guess the most successful restaurant in history, one of the reasons is that it owns all the real estate that the restaurants are located on. McDonald's is really a real estate company posing as a hamburger chain. And that's one of the things that's made it so successful, is being at those key pieces of real estate that people are going to stop by and giving them convenient access to fast food. So just a little tidbit for you there. Contrast that with a company like Starbucks, who leases space as a tenant from other property owners, which is what the vast majority of businesses do that have physical locations. Or I shouldn't say that. I actually don't know what the vast majority of businesses do, but many businesses do. So real estate can have characteristics of both a pure capital investment, i.e. paper assets, what we're going to talk about next, and private businesses, which we've already talked about. It requires some work and skill to operate, but can also have passive elements to it. And this is particularly true when renting out a piece of real estate. Back in the 18th century America, when the country was first getting started, wealth was largely defined by land ownership, and I should mention slave ownership too. A lot, if not all, of America's founding fathers were landowners. So when Thomas Jefferson owned his estate, his wealth was largely in the physical real estate that he owned. And that was a symbol of social status as well as wealth. And so even now, if you look at the public disclosures of congressmen and women, you'll notice a lot of real estate holdings in their assets. And it's actually kind of interesting to go look at that. There are lots of business holdings as well in the form of partnerships and publicly traded stocks. But the House of Representatives and the Senate, they love their real estate. Another thing is that real estate, it tends to grow with inflation, and it's also heavily affected by interest rates. As of early 2018, when I'm recording this right now, we've been in a low interest rate environment in America for many years, which has made borrowing for real estate purchases easier, and that's precipitated climbing prices in many of the U.S. markets right now. So just something to consider there. The price appreciation tends to follow inflation. This inflation index growth, it tends to correlate not just to the price of the real estate itself, but also the rents that you can charge for your tenants in that property. So if a tenant's wages increase with inflation, then that means that they can afford to pay more toward the rent as well. So that's why the rent goes up. It's inflation, right? So I've zoned in a little bit on kind of the single family home renting example just now, but let's zoom out a little bit again and look at the broader asset class of real estate and real assets. So other than single family homes, there are many, many other types of investments that you can make in real estate. You can invest in mobile home parks. You can invest in duplexes, triplexes, quadplexes. You can invest in apartment complexes, commercial office buildings, strip malls. There are hotels, motels. There are even storage unit facilities, farmland, or even just raw land that's out there in the country somewhere. You can buy it with the hopes of appreciating it or developing that real estate and building on it for commercial or residential use. So there's so many options here with real estate, and they all have their unique advantages too. So an advantage for investing in real estate is that many investors are naturally drawn toward it for a couple of different reasons. The first thing is that it's tangible. It's a physical thing. You can see it and touch it with your hands. You can feel the bricks. You can open the door. You can turn on the oven if it's a single family home. And I think there's a strong psychological aspect to that because a lot of us grew up in homes and it's familiar to us. It's got that tangible aspect. Another thing is that it can, to a large degree, be controlled. You can upgrade the appliances if you want to. You can change the flooring or the lighting, or you can paint the siding the way that you like or the way that you think that tenants will be attracted to it. You have a greater level of control over the investment itself. You can also buy real estate with borrowed money. You can use leverage. So it's kind of like back in the mid-2000s, there were all of those kind of hokey real estate investing seminars like no money down or buy real estate with nothing or open 5 credit cards and I'll show you how to buy 20 properties types of events. So that is a lot of the luster of real estate too, is that even just buying a house as a primary resident, you can go to a bank, you can say, hey, I want to buy this whatever $100,000, $200,000 house, and I only want to put a few thousand dollars into it myself. Will you lend me the rest of the money and have me pay it back to you over 30 years with interest? And so obviously this is very common and many people do this, but that's one of the major advantages, is that the United States government and many industries as well look kindly upon someone willing to purchase property through the use of borrowed funds. And so you can really juice the investment returns from the asset by putting less money down. So it's a double-edged sword though, but it's nonetheless an attractive option that many people look to. Another advantage of real estate is that it can provide a large chunk of its return in the form of regular income, in the case of rental real estate specifically. So overall rates of return for real estate, and again, I'm not a real estate investor, but from what I've heard and what I've read, you can make 10%+ a year on non-leveraged real estate. So say real estate, a house that you buy appreciates at an average rate of 3% or 4% a year, just as far as its price, but you can also collect 6% of your initial investment in the form of rental income. While you add that together, you've got 10% total returns, and all the way up to 20-30%+ a year, depending on the deal structure and how leverage is used to juice those returns. So if you buy a house with almost no money down and you collect almost as much rental income as you would if you had bought that house in cash, then your cash on cash return is extraordinary percentage wise. So yeah, that's just an example. And yeah, disclaimer, I'm not a real estate investor, so not speaking from personal experience, but if you just look at the math and listen to people who have done it, it is possible to generate great returns on real estate, whether or not you borrow to purchase it. There are also tax advantages to real estate that are unique to the asset class. You can write off things as depreciation because the physical systems in the house break down over time, and you can write part of that off on your taxes as an expense. So there's all sorts of special rules, many of which I don't know, but I know enough of them to know that, wow, okay, you can really decrease your expenses with a rental real estate investment. So on to the disadvantages of real estate. It's relatively illiquid. You typically can't just sell it on a moment's notice. This is changing somewhat because companies are leveraging the networking power of the internet in order to match buyers and sellers more quickly. So that you're starting to see real estate commissions maybe come down a little bit, but all in all, it's still a relatively illiquid asset. You can't just decide, oh, I'm going to sell this house and then tomorrow it's sold. You have to go through a process. So that can be a disadvantage. Another disadvantage is the cost of ownership can be relatively high. Just for fun, I looked up a $200,000 house in a Chicago suburb, and a 3-bedroom house, it can cost over $4,500 in property taxes per year, just for the taxes, and not to mention the maintenance, the insurance, and interest costs. And don't forget about the homeowners association fees if that's applicable. So there's a lot of things you have to worry about when you own a piece of property. There are just things that you have to pay. And from that, I can't speak from personal experience because I've owned some real estate before. And yeah, it costs money to operate, even just as a resident. So now I want to get into, really, I think, you know, my favorite, paper assets, right? This is called stock stories for a reason, and stocks are a form of paper assets. So here we're not just talking about stocks, though. It's about any form of ownership that can be quote-unquote securitized via legal contract. So anything that can be basically made onto a piece of paper as a contract, hey, you own a piece of this, that's a paper asset. Now, when it comes to paper assets, ask the question that the father of value investing, Benjamin Graham, asked many years ago. He said, for what price and on what terms? When you're buying an investment, not just paper assets, but really any asset in general, think about the price that you're paying for the asset and the terms of the contract. And so when it comes to paper assets, that's really what you're dealing with. And so with stocks, you're exchanging money for a piece of ownership in a company. And we're going to talk more about this later. It is a Stock Stories podcast, of course. But you're buying a piece of ownership in a company. And it's a contract that entitles you to those profits or a portion of those profits. There are fixed income investments. So think about, you're exchanging money with someone in the form of a loan, and you're expecting them to pay it back to you, as well as an agreed upon interest payment, or what is sometimes called the coupon. So you can have certificates of deposit. That's a fixed income investment. You go to your local bank, you give them some money, they say, all right, we'll hold this money for you, and in exchange for allowing us to have this as part of our deposits, we'll pay you a little bit of interest. Also, there's the entire bond market. So bonds can be issued by government entities or by companies. So say they're building a bridge in your hometown and they need to raise a ton of money to create that as far as the your local government. They may float some bonds, and I say float as in issuing. They're going to create these bonds so that investors can get paid a percentage of interest. And in exchange for that, they're literally building the infrastructure of the community by funding the construction of that bridge. So that's an example from a government entity. From a company, companies just need to borrow large sums of money to run their operations sometimes. So think about a electric utility company. They're going to sell a lot of bonds in order to upgrade their infrastructure to provide electricity to their communities. So that's an example of bonds and fixed income investments. Another form of paper assets is, and a lot of people don't think about this one, but to me, this is one of the most beautiful ones, because it's where the creativity comes in. It's intellectual property. All right. So you could buy royalty streams by purchasing the patent of an invention, or you could try to purchase the rights to music. You can buy Kanye West or Taylor Swift's latest album if you paid a high enough price for it and got their attention. An example about this that I really like is Michael Jackson. So back in the 80s, him and Paul McCartney were becoming friends or doing music together. And Paul McCartney says to Michael Jackson, like, hey, you realize you can actually like buy music from other people, and as a business interest, in case you want to increase your income. And Michael Jackson was like, oh, okay, all right. And he started buying some music. Well, fast forward some years, the opportunity actually came up for Michael Jackson to buy a large portion of the Beatles catalog. And he paid, I forget how much he paid tens of millions of dollars for the Beatles catalog. And Paul McCartney wasn't very happy about this, but nonetheless, that asset, that intellectual property, ended up contributing a lot to Michael Jackson's family fortune, because those were valuable assets. So you can buy the rights to royalty streams to music. On the invention side, think about someone who invents a medical device or a kitchen gadget and licenses its use to a company in exchange for royalty sales that are based on the sale of the product. So that's another way that intellectual property can be used to generate investment returns. It's a contract that you sign with someone who agrees to sell and distribute something, but it's all based upon that idea, that creativity in the form of that invention or that work of music or a trademark or any number of things. Another thing is paper assets that are based on real assets. So my favorite example of this are REITs, which is REITS, and that stands for Real Estate Investment Trust. It's a way for you to invest in real estate kind of via the stock market, but the company you're purchasing shares of exclusively owns real estate in some way or another. And so that's an example where you're kind of indirectly owning a real asset, but you're doing it through paper assets. So that's just another kind of subcategory there. Another example of paper assets are the most basic one, cash and cash equivalents, currency, US dollars, money, moolah, guap, whatever you want to call it, cash. Also, Japanese yen, Swiss francs, Thai baht, Bitcoin, Litecoin, all those digital cryptocurrencies that are coming out now, those are cash equivalents. They're a form of currency, and they fluctuate relative to each other, and they're mediums of exchange to at least some degree. So, all right, so let's look at what are the advantages of paper assets. So, paper assets, you can own a small piece of a large enterprise with little effort. So, for example, you can own a share of ExxonMobil and you can buy right now. You could go online, buy a share of ExxonMobil, and boom, you own a small piece of one of the largest integrated oil and gas companies in the world that's pumping out just millions of barrels of oil a day. You could do that right now. Isn't that amazing? So that's one of the advantages, is just the liquidity of paper assets. So another advantage is that you can receive truly passive income from this form of investment. So with real estate, yeah, you're collecting rent, but at the end of the day, you got to make sure that your tenants are there and they're paying you and your property's up to date. It's somewhat passive, but not purely passive. And with businesses, you can, I guess, create it passively, but you still have to do a ton of work up front. There's some work that has to be done with the business asset class at some phase in order to get income from it. But with paper assets, you're literally just exchanging money for the right to receive money in the future, or the hopes of receiving money in the future. I shouldn't say right, except for in the case of bonds, which you're legally obligated to be paid. But even then, your creditor could, is it creditor? Or your debtor could default, and you don't get anything. But yeah, you're exchanging money in the hopes that someone is just going to pay you later for your ownership. So you can get royalties, rents, dividends, interest payments. You can have all those flowing into your accounts as you continue to collect paper assets throughout your lifetime. So there's little to no work involved once you've decided what to buy, and you keep a watch on the company or whatever the asset is. You're just gonna receive money, or in the form of capital gains when you sell it. So another advantage is that you can still get high rates of return depending on the asset. So we talked about how real estate can generate great returns, private businesses can generate nearly unlimited returns, and in the stock market, you're not going to get as much returns, but you can still generate great wealth. And it can range from negative. So for example, if you short a stock and you bet against it, you actually can end up owing money. That's kind of a tricky situation, which maybe I'll explain it in a future episode, but you can actually lose money, like below zero, in that case, all the way up to owning Chipotle stock back in 2006, whereas if you held that through 2015, you would have made 30%+ annually on just that holding. So you can compound wealth incredibly with the stock market as well, and just paper assets in general too. So that's an advantage there. So the average rates of return of the US stock market over the past century or so have been around 10-11%. I think it varies a little bit depending on the source data. You can check out Standard & Poor's official website for records there. Also, Ibbotson and Associates has a lot of historical rate of return data for various asset classes, that you can check that out. So around 10-11% over a long period of time, we're talking decades, to kind of put that in perspective. So those are advantages. Disadvantages of this asset class are you lack control in a lot of cases. So for example, with bonds, you can buy some bonds. Some bonds have a feature that says they're callable, which means that someone's paying you back interest, and then they decide, you know what, I want to pay this debt off. So they can pay you back principal before it comes due. And so then it's like, oh, well, I was getting used to this nice stream of interest payments, but oh, not anymore. I just got my principal back. So the deal's been satisfied. Not all bonds are like that, but just an example of where you don't have all the control in the situation. And I guess a bigger example related to stocks is that unless you're personally on the board of directors of the company, you have absolutely no control over how that company's management conducts its operations. So you just have to to make sure that the people who are managing the companies of the shares you own are being wise stewards of the capital that you're giving in exchange for that ownership. Unless you manage to buy millions and millions of shares of a company and acquire a significant enough percentage ownership to really get their attention, you got no control. So keep that in mind. Another disadvantage is that the quoted market value of your holdings can change rapidly with paper assets. So, example of this, October 19th, 1987, the Dow Jones dropped 22% in a single day. A single day. So, you can watch your wealth seemingly vanish overnight. But remember, these are just quoted market prices. They don't necessarily reflect the underlying intrinsic value of the investments that you have in that given moment. It's an auction system where people are buying and selling at certain prices, right? But nonetheless, still psychologically kind of devastating to realize, whoa, I had $100 and now it's 80 or whatever the number is. So that's a disadvantage. Another disadvantage is kind of like we talked about a little bit before with the rate of return, the advantage side of it, there's a disadvantage side of it. Your returns are mathematically limited by market forces when you're investing in paper assets, specifically stocks. So once a company begins to raise capital at the level where people in the public can buy into it, there's only so much market territory where it can expand into. An example of this is with Berkshire Hathaway. So there's a mental model out there called the law of large numbers. So once you have an investment or an amount of money that's so big, you can't get as high of a percentage of a return from that because there just aren't as much opportunities out there to grow at that pace. So there just aren't enough companies out there big enough to buy for Berkshire Hathaway where it will make a huge difference percentage-wise to the bottom line as compared to a young Berkshire Hathaway when Warren Buffett was buying companies left and right because he could get a high percentage rate of return on them and based on the amount of capital that he had at the time. So those are some of the disadvantages of paper assets. Whew. All right. So thanks for sticking with me through all that. As you can see, there is so much out there. There you have it. There are many, many subclasses of assets, but an easy way to think about it is that every investment that you can make falls into one of those three categories. You have businesses, you have real assets, mainly real estate, and you have paper assets. And of paper assets, I like to talk about stocks. So in future episodes, we're going to talk about stocks. But there's the whole universe of opportunities for you. And as you can see, each has their own characteristics. You may prefer some over others for psychological reasons or just your personality lends itself to certain asset classes. As I said earlier, certain people just love real estate and they only ever want to invest in real estate. Cool, that's good for them. Some people only ever want to invest in stocks or only ever want to write books for a living and collect royalties on the book sales. Everyone is different. Every investor is different. Everyone has their own goals and their own time frame. So that should be kept in mind. Now, I like paper assets. I like stocks. I think it's pretty amazing that you can participate economically with a huge enterprise that's doing incredible things out there in the world and creating amazing products and services for people. I think it's incredible that we get to participate in that at this point in human history. And I also think it's great that you can exchange capital for receiving future benefits with no work, really. Once you've done the work and the research, obviously not every investment works out, but some will. And it could really change your life over a long enough period of time because of that nature of compound interest. and the economic forces at work when you're buying shares of a company that's rewarding its shareholders. So those are just some of the reasons why I like stocks and why I like them as a subset of the paper asset class. So there you have it. That's an overview of the three asset classes. And in the next episode, we are going to talk about just stocks. We're just going to talk about stocks, a little bit about the history, and we're honing down little by little, and then we're going to get into the main content of the show, which is the analysis of individual companies. So I'll see you in the next episode. Information presented here on Stock Stories is for informational, educational, and entertainment purposes only. You and you alone are responsible for your investment and financial decisions. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, or financial advisor that can analyze your specific situation in the context of your goals and circumstances.